You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Anna Johnson. Anna, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you. Hi.
Anna, we're going to be talking about your show, of course, your beautiful show at Kutaisi Gallery, and I'm excited to get into this and talk about this work. Part of this work comes from your, as I understand it, what I read about it, although it wouldn't be apparent from seeing it, is that you grew up in New York and are now living in a very different environment. Is that correct?
Yeah, I live in Australia. I lived in New York on and off from 1969 to around 2010. Bouncing between Sydney and New York, but primary long stretches of time in the 70s, 90s, and 2000s, yeah.
Because you have an Australian accent, not a New York accent.
No, right? Well, you know, it's not the most pleasant, is it? I mean, they beat it out of me with a large stick. Yeah,
It's what? Tell me about Australia. Yeah, and the difference between Australia and New York.
It's extremely Anglo-centric, though I must say we've become a lot more Americanized, possibly in the last three decades. But, when you come back early high school, you sort of have to adapt. So, yeah, I don't have an American accent, but I certainly speak really fast at times.
And so let's talk about this show. This is a beautiful show, and... you know, the reason I asked about New York and Australia is because though everything here is abstract, I don't want to speak to these as landscapes, but your environment affects these, right? Whether you're painting in New York or Australia?
I think it's about sensibility. You would find that a huge majority of very successful Australian artists paint landscapes, and they all live in cities. There's an idea of an idealized interior. I also think it's kind of funny, all over the world, corporations buy landscape paintings. Often the biggest pillagers are obsessed with the landscape trope. So it's really, it's not a literal idea of interpretation or environment. It's basically a sensibility. So even though I grew up in cities, my palette is informed by the brief experiences I've had in nature. And it was more cultural. I was raised in a family of abstract artists, so we could have lived in Ayers Rock. It wouldn't have mattered. It was an aesthetic rather than environmental sensibility.
Tell me a little bit about your family growing up in a family of artists, because, of course, that creates a huge impression. And, you know, just before we started this talk, off the record, we were talking a little bit about parenting and homeschooling. So as parents, as artists, you also grew up with artists. How did that affect you? Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I think that's special, right? Growing up with artists, parenting, artist parenting are one of my favorite subjects.
Well, some people got to do soccer and have piano classes on Saturday, but I was basically raised in a bar, Finelli's, which is in Soho. It's a fairly famous tourist attraction now, but... in the very early 70s, it was really a hotbed for painters. It was very much the painter's bar. And so, you know, like a symposium, we just turn up at the bar at, I don't know, midday and stay till closing time. And so I listened to people arguing about art in a very fervent, very freaked out, earnest way every Saturday for almost my entire childhood till I was 11. And as a result, I found writing about art quite easy because it's all people talked about when I grew up. and if we weren't at the bar, you know, we were sitting around the kitchen table arguing about Galitsky and Roscoe and stuff. So it was very much like being raised in a Christian sect, except that the cult was abstract painting, an orthodoxy, if you'd like. It's pretty...
I love that. Yeah, that's so kind of amazing and funny. And, of course, that was an incredible time in history, too, the Finelli Bar at that stage in history and the artists that were there. What was the kind of orthodoxy that you remember from that? I mean, that's such a young and impressionable age, if you remember anything
sort
from
of,
that.
Well, There was a very high freak quotient, so you could never really tell who was friend or foe. Particularly, like the barman, Mike Finelli, was a real prohibition kind of wise guy, and he kept a baseball bat behind the counter for any trouble. You know, which I suppose goes back to the mob days, sort of Scorsese material. Anyway, he gave us like a flowing river of ginger ale. I'm just amazed I don't have ginger ale poisoning from my childhood, because we drank so many Shirley Temples. One woman who had feathers all through her hair came and asked me if I wanted to literally paint New York red. And I said, where are the brushes? Where's your paint? Because, you know, you're a child. And what else? Well, I think it's very funny that the artists now who are considered the most famous, the most successful, were a band of outsiders. And so every generation thinks they're a band of outsiders. But I do distinctly remember Julian Schnabel coming in and really getting short shrift from my father's generation. And then, you know what, 20, 15 years later, I'm sitting in Finelli's having a nostalgic ginger ale, and who should walk in but Schnabel, straight out of the Mercer Hotel, looking so rich. And I think the cycles in New York turn very quickly. But the primary experience of growing up with artists is actually watching them make art. You know, sitting there watching your father paint, going to visit your grandmother, and she's in a room with 50, 60 paintings, as many as she can fit into a room, because my grandmother was a really fantastic painter. Some would say she was an outsider artist, very untrained, very fauvist, but it's strange what comes down through the blood. I don't like it when people say, oh, you're good with colour, it must be genetic. I find that a little bit insulting, but there is something in it, because it's not really what you can do with your hands, it's what you look for in the environment or a room, anywhere you are. So I feel like I come from a long line of people who are looking for colour.
Let's talk about that, looking for color in that bar, that expression, because that's a way of thinking, that's kind of a pedagogy, that's a whole world, right? Looking for color. Let's jump into that a little bit more. That phrase comes from, what you were saying is almost kind of an insulting reference, but also that comes from, again, the Finelli bar and what you heard at the time.
Well, what you see as well. So we were dragged around museums, and, you know, in summer when there's no air conditioning, I was talking about the 70s, we'd either go to an all-night cinema and watch a, you know, Woody Allen marathon. We weren't really big fans, but the air conditioning was awesome. I remember sleeping in cinemas all the time. That was one solution. And the other was to hang out at the Museum of Modern Art. So we were really saturated from a very young age, and we saw some ridiculous things. Hermann Nitsch was throwing blood, so much pig's blood, around a gallery in Soho that it was coming down the stairs. My mother said it was just ketchup, but we knew better. But another unmentionable artist had put a paintbrush in his primary orifice, and his family was sitting on the other side of the glass watching. And strangely enough, I just thought all this was perfectly normal. So I had struggled with social norms as I got older, because my childhood was so culturally adventurous. Pushing the boundaries of taste, never mind other orthodoxies. It's pretty funny.
That's something.
That's wacky, but it's getting away from color field painting. I know that. But this extremes of the 70s.
Yeah, is the things that you were growing up in. I mean, you know, Hermann Nitsch and the artist you're talking about, I don't know if that was Carson, but people... what?
You know that guy? He's not in prison?
But, you know, I mean, these are all events that were kind of, I don't know him at all, no, but there was something, he was kind of a very transgressive artist. But so these are the things that you grew up with that were also kind of bizarre, right? I mean, this isn't just the world of painting or abstract expressionism. As you said, there was a kind of a freak quotient to all of this.
Well, you know, the Freaks wanted to inherit New York. They were the only people willing to live there, really. I mean, Chelsea was so different. We went to the first gay march, and there were people, you know, in plastic see-through suits on stilts. It was very, New York was kind of a mixture of Midnight Cowboy and Fellini. You know, that was my experience of it. And so to come back and have a show in Chelsea, what, 5 decades later, talk about full circle. This is a pretty naughty thing to say, but I'm not a great fan of Chelsea. When I went to the galleries in the 90s, early 2000s, I just couldn't stand the sterility because I'd grown up in such a different milieu. Anyway, I'm happy to get along to the actual talking about the paintings, but the background is interesting.
Well, it is interesting, and it says a lot about it, because the milieu you grew up in was, by saying it's so different than the Chelsea of today, was because it wasn't so antiseptic, right? So white walls. There was something scrappier. There was something freakier about it, as you said. There was something a little more almost anarchic about it, right? There was, well, you said, I think, very aptly between, you know, kind of Fellini film almost... almost vibe. That was that's what you were raised on. That's what made these paintings.
Well, we were banded together. Yeah. Well, also if you chose, we did have, you know, all people seem to see the 70s through is a lens of real estate. On Instagram, you know, they have all these romantic depictions of how cheaply you could get a loft. But the thing is, you have to balance that out with how few employment prospects that there are for, you know, a family of four. My mother was a ticket salesperson at the Elgin Revival Cinema, and she also helped run a secondhand store called the Velvet Underground, so near the Chelsea Hotel. So I spent a lot of time by myself. At home, I would just be thrown a huge pad of paper and 5 pens. And I spent a lot of time, because Revival Cinema was enormous, I spent a lot of time drawing and looking at a black and white television. And so when I wasn't there, I was at the shop trying on vintage clothing. And when I wasn't there, I was watching silent film. So it was a weird mix of sort of nostalgia and the avant-garde. I remember everybody was obsessed with 1930s and 20s and silent film. Everybody was living in a kind of strange mixture of improvisation and nostalgia. And everyone felt very young. That's, you know, it was strange, you know, we did have one neighbor, Edwin Denby, who's a famous composer, and he was really the only old person I knew, except for people at the Chelsea who all felt like they were in this twilight zone, a strange Edwardian kind of atmosphere in that hotel. But yeah, my primary impression was that everybody was wearing secondhand clothing and eating at the Asia de Cuba and just, that was the way we all were, yeah.
And the paintings in this show, they were talking about, you know, your history and growing up and being between two worlds. Do you feel that these reflect Australia more than New York, or is it not about that? Is it about a kind of state of mind? I mean, because as you said, these aren't, you know, landscapes really, right? They're completely abstract.
Well, I don't, it's not a strong landscape basis. The landscape in my work comes out of late 19th century French painting, particularly Monet, and the screens of the Heian period in Japan, which is sort of 8th to 12th century. So I'm looking at landscape through the lens of other art, not so much the primary experience, because in fact, the landscape in Australia is really very diffuse and hard to capture. When you walk through a gum forest in Australia, it is a lot of grey and ochre plants diffused by this really bright light. It's like walking through a kind of silver prism. And I'd find that, I don't think there's anything more difficult to paint than a tree in a sea of bright light. I think of nothing worse, so stressful in a way. And I think I come to landscape through the prism of other painters. More than anything,
and the work in this show is almost a geographic. Go on. It's a geographic.
It's a geometric underpinning, rather than a geographic reality. I use Monet. I slide into every painting on this deep diagonal because that's actually the formal underpinning of every picture I make. But also with Monet, his use of abstract space and the Japanese screen painters from the 8th century to the present, their use of abstract space. I'm possibly more interested in the void within landscape than the detail. You know, so it's not a scene. People can come to a painting and find a tree or a mountain or a cloud, but that's their subjective reflection. That's their visual memory coming into play. But the primacy of the abstract experience for me is that if you see a landscape, have it, Mont Saint-Victoire, go for it. And if you don't, well, that's probably closer to my own perception. I can't stand the idea of a view. You know, I need depth. I need to actually fall through space or feel like I'm immersed in water. The idea of a static view is horrifying to me and so boring. I know this is going to sound controversial, but I can't stand mountains and paintings of mountains. They make me feel like I'm buried alive.
That's fine to say. You can do what you want here. Well, the title of the show, of course, translates cloud and void, as I understand. Mm-hmm. So that speaks to kind of the space that you're talking about. However, the works in the show, right, avoiding anything like a mountain, seem also avoid a horizon line, right? Sometimes these seem to be aerial, or we could be moving through a forest, but there isn't a kind of reference for scale in these, or a reference to a landscape. We may see voids, but we're not even aware that these are referencing clouds necessarily. Although the more you say that, I can see that, or voids, they are without references to land, correct? Or is that not how they were intended? Or unless we're talking about sort of aerial views.
No, we've got to get away from the earth signs. I'm a Pisces, right? So for me, the idea of a terrestrial boundary or horizon line really plants the viewer into, like I say, this gazing at a static scenery or across the horizon. My fixation with Monet and all the paintings that I've made out of Nymphia are to do with reflection. So I want the painting to have an immersive ambiguity where you can feel like you are in an aerial reality, like looking down on Earth almost as a cartography, or you could be looking up at the sky through a body of water. The idea of being submerged and aerial at the same time is an experience that I have when I'm making the work, and I kind of want to invite people into the idea of a non-fixed perception. Are you beneath, above, or within? Because actually, we are all that. You know, the idea of a landscape is actually an impossible fiction, which we've invented almost, I don't really know why we've invented the idea of the landscape. Because whenever we're walking through a crowded bar or a desert, there's always the peripheral just at the edge of your glasses. You're never going to see it. And I think a painting is an enormous kind of simile for impossible viewpoints, because every painting has the edge. That's it. You've got the perimeter. We're all up against that perimeter. But if you make a painting that is aqueous, terrestrial, aerial, subterranean, I'm trying to fight the idea of the perimeter and the edge. I'm trying to bash my way out of it. So the idea of a multivalent viewpoint, that's a lot to hang on my show. I don't think I'm achieving it quite. But these are the things I'm exploring in my picture. The idea of a single spectacle is unbearable, and that's where the void comes in. So, you know, for example, there's a very famous screen. I was in Tokyo recently, and there's this famous screen where Kyoto is seen through the break in clouds. So the view is aerial, and your focus on buildings and landmarks and temples is better than looking at a map, because the cloud makes your concentration possible, and the view in that huge screen is aerial. So I think the use of clouds, space, interrupted space, detail is huge in this particular show, my first solo show in New York.
And is it, you know, that's such a kind of hard to grasp notion in a way. All these ways of seeing at once. There's something very internal about that, right? You said also that this is the space you're in when you're painting. So that space sounds, it's a mental space, right? It's a psychic space. It's almost a mystical space, it sounds like, to be seeing all of that at once and have a kind of, and still have your feet on the ground.
No, I think that's the long view. I think a lot of artists make really tricky claims for their work once they've made it. The primary experience of making the painting, it's a lot more formalist. Basically, space is the structural kind of pattern of my work, but color is the driving force. And I actually think I use the voids. You can concentrate on the color a little more. I don't paint on a ground. I don't have like an... It's not like Frankenthaler where there's an aqueous ground. I actually work into raw linen. And what I really want people to enjoy is the color and the unpredictability of color. So, yeah, basically I don't want any boring bits.
I like that so much. I like that.
Tectonic. Yeah. Like a pinball machine almost. That's how I want the color to work.
Anna, thanks for sharing that with me. Of course, for listeners here, there's more links so you can explore, learn more about this work. Anna, is there anything else you want to add before we go about this show or painting in general?
Within my show are different experiences of the void and scale within a discipline of a canvas. One thing I've really noticed is this persistent argument between representational art and abstract art, landscape and abstraction. But what makes me really feel quite bemused is that all painting has an essential abstraction. People come to an abstract painting and feel they have to bring a certain intelligence or adventurous perception to it, like listening to jazz rather than a rock song. However, you can approach every painting in the same way because essentially every painting is impossible. It's an exercise in the impossible. You're taking a flat, two-dimensional surface and you're generating an image. So to me, there is no defining or distinct line between a landscape painting and an abstract painting because it's all an exercise in impossibility and illusion. And so when someone comes into Noir Javid, if they find clouds, if they find trees, if they find nothing or everything, that's all valid perception. Because actually painting has a shared link of a kind of suspended faith in reality. And those are the things I'm interested in painting. And I really don't care if someone sees something very literal or something they can't name. For me, that's a successful painting.
Anna, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.